Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today on Sunday, July 3rd, 2005, here in Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. A beautiful, lovely summer Sunday day here in the heartland. Today, I'm back in action after 3 weeks on the road scouting out Media Matters programs for you, my great listeners. And we have a wonderful show to return to. Author of a brand new book called War Made Easy, one of the leading journalists and syndicated columnists on media in the United States today, Norman Solomon will be our guest today on Media Matters. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Two major decisions handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court on June 27th have serious implications for the future of freedom of information online. At stake in the case known as Brand X versus FCC was the future of open access to the broadband internet, and specifically whether cable companies have to open their networks to competing internet service providers. In a 6-3 decision, the court ruled they do not. Jeff Chester is executive director of the Center for Digital Democracy, one of the petitioners in the Brand X case. He says the court just extended the cable industry's monopoly power over television content distribution to the online world.
These big companies will use their last mile control to, in essence, flood the online medium and target users with all matter of commercial content, particularly from advertisers.
Without competition at the access level for broadband service, the majority of Americans will now be restricted to just two options, the cable company or dominant phone company, most likely a baby Bell. Chester says the FCC's already moved to give phone companies the same access exclusivity that cable systems have, and Congress is too far deep into the pockets of both industries to take up the issue. And although local governments have the final say on a cable system's operations via the franchise agreement process, he doesn't think that can be used to mandate open access.
The Supreme Court decision makes it even murkier whether cities, when they negotiate cable franchises, have any say whatsoever in how cable broadband serves their communities.
But the future of broadband access doesn't have to be so bleak. Chester says it's time for some serious grassroots organization to document the fallout from Brand X and begin lobbying now for regulatory changes to restore competition between internet service providers on both cable and telephone networks.
I think there has to be a kind of short and medium term, digital guerrilla war against the cable and telephone companies. Show there is discrimination. Develop new coalitions, because there's plenty of even big companies fearful of what this means for them once the cable and telephone industry can prefer, for example, their content over others. So we're in for a multi-year campaign to try to reverse this decision.
The Supreme Court also ruled on whether developers of file-sharing software are ultimately responsible for the actions of their users. The central issue in the case of MGM versus Grokster involves the sharing of copyrighted content. The court decided that peer-to-peer program developers should be held liable for illicit content sharing, but only if it can be proven that they actively induce such behavior. Matthew Netto, general counsel for Streamcast Networks, one of two peer-to-peer companies targeted by the movie and music industries, says this ruling will chill innovation among those who seek to improve content management and distribution systems.
The guy in the garage, the gal in the executive suite, had better be very sophisticated about what they think, let alone what they communicate with each other, let alone what they communicate with their potential customers, because their every thought and their every action will now be subject to discovery in expensive litigation. It seems to me that this will be a full lawyer employment outcome. When there's this great a degree of uncertainty, lawyers are going to get pulled into every aspect of innovation and business.
Mike Godwin, legal director of the digital rights advocacy group Public Knowledge, is worried that phone and cable companies might use the ruling to preemptively filter content and thereby restrict what users can find online.
Well, the content companies come after me and say, you're providing broadband, you know that some high percentage of the people who are using your broadband services are downloading copyrighted works. There's some discussion in the majority opinion about what can be inferred from the lack of imposing filters for copyrighted works. I think that the broadband companies also feel that they may be in the crosshairs here.
However, Public Knowledge President Gigi San put a positive spin on the decision, noting that it did not outlaw file-sharing technology outright. The court also upheld a longstanding precedent that just because a technology can be used to duplicate copyrighted work should not restrict its use.
And in fact, the court reaffirmed that peer-to-peer as a technology can be used for substantial non-infringing uses.
It's also important to note this decision only clears the way for a lawsuit against peer-to-peer companies. And those involved in this particular litigation are confident that they can prove their innocence against charges that they actively promote copyright infringement.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Coming to you live today here from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois. And it is a beautiful Sunday afternoon. We are going to be joined today on our program by Norman Solomon, author of the brand new book, War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. We're in the process now of hooking up with Norman Solomon and getting him on the line. He is out on the West Coast, and we are furtively working with our producers and engineers to hook up with Norman. We should have him here momentarily. In the meantime, let me tell you a little bit about what is coming up on Media Matters in the coming weeks. We have 1 week from today, Mark Crispin Miller will be our guest joining us to talk about his new book, which is on the 2004 election. The press coverage of it, and specifically the vote count in Ohio. So that'll be 1 week from today. We have Mark Crispin Miller. But now I am informed by our producer, Andrew Boyle, that we do indeed have Norman Solomon here to join us in the phones. Norman, are you there?
Yes. Hi, Bob.
Hey, Norman. Thank you so much for joining us today on Media Matters.
Very glad to be here.
Norman Solomon, I think for our listeners who are have listened to the program for a long time, is well known to many of you. He's been on the show several times before. He's a syndicated columnist in media and politics. His media column, Media Beat, has been in national syndication since 1992. Today we're talking to Norman about his new book that has just come out. Norman, I think it's just come out this week, hasn't it?
That's right.
Called War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. And it is published by John T. Wiley and has just come out. And Norman, this book is by far the biggest thing you've written, right? I mean,
yeah.
In terms of it's a major commercial house, it looks like you're really, you've stepped up a class. You've come from the Common Courage world through to the top now, it looks like.
Well, I tried to make it really rigorous and yet accessible, and, you know, people will make their own assessment, but the weight of the issue kind of propelled me forward, given the perpetual war environment we're in and how the media are covering it.
Yeah, and I mean, I've had a chance to, I got the book on Saturday and have had a chance to look at it, or I got it Friday, actually, and have a chance to look at it the last 2 days, and it is really an extraordinary book, and I say this about a lot of the books in the show, because they are extraordinary, but this is one, you know, we've had a lot of guests on the show talking about the press coverage of the Iraq War and the press coverage of U.S. foreign policy. This is a book that simply isn't making the same points all our listeners are familiar with, but that really has a rich, detailed history to put sort of the current situation in context that makes the book one I especially want to talk about on the show. And I urge our listeners interested in the topic to get a copy of the book, again titled War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death, author Norman Solomon, our guest today. I mean, what would you sum up as the point of the book, Norman?
Well, that what's gone on in the last few years in terms of the agenda building and the execution of the invasion of Iraq is not an anomaly. That contrary to the standard critique made in the news media, invading a country and lying ahead of time out of the White House and the executive branch and largely the Congress about the reasons for the invasion, that's not just some kind of aberration that has happened upon us because of a particularly venal president and a particularly subservient media. Those are the conditions under which we've been living in recent years, but to a significant degree, this has been going on for many decades, and the structural and political failures of the news media are continually dragging this country into one war after another.
How far back would you say the relationship goes?
Well, I went in this book, perhaps to some degree arbitrarily, in my lifetime, the last 40 years, beginning with the Vietnam War and the oft-forgotten invasion of the Dominican Republic. But I think we're really going back through the history of this country. As far as I'm aware of it, there's the terrible diary entry from President McKinley, where he talks about his decision to give the blessings of the U.S. military to the people of the Philippines. And he talks about how the necessity was there to bring Christianity to those heathens. Of course, at that time, we had people like Mark Twain, who were able to get some media coverage of their denunciations. But I think on the whole, the press has been pretty subservient to the war makers in Washington.
Now, this book is about war makers, presidents and military institutions in the United States on one hand, and it's also about media. And has the role of the media changed in the past 100 years, would you say, or let's say 40 years since you start, say, in the 60s, or has it been pretty much a constant relationship?
Well, I think stylistically there have been a lot of shifts, but underlying a lot of the boilerplates have remained the same. I didn't set out working on this book to particularly find parallels between the current war in Iraq and the Vietnam War, but they kept hitting me between the eyes when I would go back and read the coverage in the 60s, and I think that's reflected in the latter chapters of the book, where I think a lot of the psychological mechanisms that are both at play in the news media and then exploited in the population are very similar. A lot of the boilerplate arguments, you know, the nobility of our own foreign policy, our leaders really are trying to bring peace. They wouldn't lie to us. We're up against some replica of Hitler. We're fighting for human rights. Butter wouldn't melt in our mouths in terms of seeking any profits for corporations as a result of the war. On and on to the current debate that we're now seeing in the news media, which I think remains inadequate but has certainly widened in recent weeks, and that is over the possibility of withdrawal. And again, we have the same arguments that are taking place. So even though 24/7 cable coverage was not in existence during the Vietnam War, and there's a lot more, like I would say, pseudo postmodernist, whatever, hip irony in the coverage and you know, a superficial layer of skepticism, underlying, I think we have a lot of the same lapdog sort of functions the news media serve towards those who are waging war out of Washington.
Conventional wisdom, Norman Solomon, about the Vietnam War and the press coverage of it, and I mean conventional in the sense of, say, mainstream journalism or political analyst, is that the press coverage of the war was largely pro-war, admittedly pro-war, into 1968 or so. And then when the Tet Offensive took place, the press coverage began to become considerably anti-war, visible demonstrations of battles and wars on the TV screens, and turned the American people to be quite hostile to the war. Is that, in your view, an accurate presentation of what happened with the press coverage of the Vietnam War?
Not really. As a matter of fact, the coverage of the Vietnam War that we now remember as being archetypes was actually atypical. You know, when CBS showed a hut being burned down with a Zippo lighter, even later on, some of the more tough coverage. Yes, the social movements from the bottom against the Vietnam War had a effect of drawing the news media into a more critical stance. But I think you could say throughout that the media coverage was steps behind where people were at the grassroots and running or at least walking to catch up. I think underlying, too, if we look at some differences, during the Vietnam War, it was the Joint Chiefs of Staff dragging or impelling the president, at least the president thought, Johnson especially, and then Nixon, that the war was necessary. Whereas we've had a reversal in recent few years. It's the White House that has been pulling a somewhat reluctant Joint Chiefs of Staff and career Pentagon to go along with the war plans. And I think this has affected the coverage in that there's been a bit more of a official source journalism basis out of Washington for journalists to cite misgivings. But a common thread, and again, I think this does relate to your question, in that all the way through the coverage of the Vietnam War, way past 1968, when, as I point out in the book, there was not a single major U.S. newspaper editorializing for withdrawal of U.S. troops from Vietnam in early 1968, we've had this tactical argument writ large as though that was the crux of the matter. It was a matter of could we win, and we're seeing that today, not only from people like Joe Biden, but many of the pundits. This war is bad because we can't win, and so as with Vietnam, largely throughout, the discourse today is not whether the war is moral, whether it can be defended morally, but whether it can be won.
We're talking to Norman Solomon today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. This is a live program. We have phone lines, and you're welcome to call in if you'd like to. The phone number is 333-9455, and the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Norman, early, about a year ago this time, both the New York Times and then Howard Kurtz and the Washington Post issued mild apologies for the inability of both the Times, or each of the Times and the Post, to call, to report critically upon the Bush administration claims of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq prior to the invasion. And they confessed they did not do a sufficient job of demanding evidence for those claims so they could put that before the American people. And after those apologies, do you think their press coverage has sort of whipped into shape? I mean, have they eliminated the source of the problems that led to that in the first place?
I don't think the essence has shifted. There's a tremendous amount of coverage in the A section in terms of news about the tactical outlook for the war, a lot of conveying of what official Washington and the U.S. military are doing. And as a matter of fact, if you look at the front page of the New York Times a couple of days ago, you see, to me, a breathtaking and jaw-dropping, and I thought I was somewhat inured and, you know, callous to this kind of stuff, agenda building for the next war in terms of Iran, where you have these two pictures of the newly elected president of Iran, who certainly was a thug. I was there a couple of weeks ago. I'm not defending this guy at all, Ahmadinejad, but the point is that the assumptions underneath the agenda building for the next war as designated by the executive branch have not shifted. And that's not surprising. You know, I quote in the book Bill Keller, the executive editor of the New York Times now, in an essay shortly before he acceded to that post a couple of years ago, where he said, you know, he was upset about the intelligence gathering of the run-up to the Iraq invasion, not because he was against the war, but because he thought it would be necessary to tune that process up for the wars yet to come. So just kind of in summary, I don't think the coverage has improved appreciably in either of those publications.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Iran, if we could, because I think that's really grows right out of your book, War Made Easy, and you've just come back from Iran. What exactly is the beef the United States has with Iran?
I think the underlying policy beef includes that there's a lot of oil in Iran, there's a lot of natural gas in Iran, and there is a total refusal of the Iranian government to play ball with the U.S. geopolitically as well as U.S. corporate interests economically. And I don't mean those are the only factors, but I think that's a big one. There is also the nuclear development going on in Iran, which is, we're told, for peaceful purposes. That's kind of an echo of the U.S. Adams for Peace line. The U.S. nuclear industry and government sold that line all too well. I was doing many interviews in Iran and found that there's much more faith in the U.S. line for nuclear power in Tehran than there is in the United States. I think there's also the Israeli connection, where Israel is very eager to have a military attack launched on Iran, and the U.S. is struggling with how to implement that sort of measure.
Now, Iraq is a nation of, what, 25, 30 million people?
Right.
Iran is a nation of almost two or three times that size, considerably wealthier nation, I think, or at least larger. Is an invasion at all plausible by the United States of Iran?
I don't think it's plausible in the near term for tactical reasons.
I mean, just
reasons.
Yeah, purely for tactical reasons, not on
right.
moral or ethical grounds.
Yeah, I do think that protracted missile strikes are feasible. For instance, we're told that gee, it's not something to be concerned about, and this is the punditocracy's verdict right now, because the U.S. Army is tied down in Iraq. But the fact is that the U.S. Waged a ferocious air war against Yugoslavia for 78 straight days, did not require many U.S. troops whatsoever, did not lose a single U.S. enlisted person in combat, and was counted as a great domestic success. And I think that while we'll see a lot more of it, we've already been able to see a lot of agenda building on two key points, purported nuclear weapons development and involvement in terrorism. And now we have, as I mentioned, this front page of the New York Times and major echo, again coming out of the White House, that because the elected president now of Iran was, we're told, you know, unproven, involved in the hostage-taking in 1979 of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran when the Shah was toppled, that somehow that makes this a particularly evil regime in Tehran coming up.
We're talking to Norman Solomon today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Norman Solomon has been a guest on this program many times before. He's a media columnist with a syndicated column called Media Beat, which has been around for around 13 years. He's also the author of a brand new book published by John Wiley & Sons called War Made Easy: How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. This is a book that is a rich compendium of analysis and evidence concerning U.S. Foreign wars over the past 40 years, and the role the media have played in supporting the claims for war, largely uncritically. The phone lines here, if you'd like to talk to Norman Solomon, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 4, Eureka, Illinois, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Yes, good afternoon. I believe you stated that up until a certain time that no U.S. newspapers had editorialized against the Vietnam War. It reminds me of a Noam Chomsky quote, I believe, saying up until 67 or 68, no negative comments could be made on it against the Vietnam War. My question is, could you elaborate a little bit more? That certainly rings true with my memory. It seemed like up until maybe Tet, there was hardly any really U.S. negative coverage of the war in Vietnam, and I'll take the answer off here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is footnoted in the book. It was a survey that the Boston Globe conducted of a few dozen major newspapers in the United States, and just found that, yeah, there was a lot of carping and objecting, and actually that began from the editorials of the New York Times as early as, say, 1965, but it was not fundamental and didn't challenge the presence of U.S. troops in Vietnam, which was around 500,000 by 1968. And the parallels now are very chilling, as I talk about in depth. In the book, there's a real reticence, and I think it's true to this moment, for U.S. media outlets that are touted as major to say, get the U.S. troops out of Iraq.
Yeah, now you're jumping ahead.
Yeah.
What about, this is an interesting issue in Iraq, more so than Vietnam. In Vietnam, there was conservative opposition to war, but not much. I mean, conservatives were upset that they weren't winning the war, but they weren't upset with the idea that we invaded Vietnam. In this war, interestingly enough, there is a branch of conservative dissidents to the war. Paul Craig Roberts comes to mind, but there's a number of other people, and also dissidents within the military and intelligence communities that's quite hostile to this war. Is this a new development you're seeing?
I think it is a new characteristic, and it has been, I think, responsible for some of the negative media coverage, and I think it came in an earlier wave in the lead-up, the several months of discourse before the war, the summer-fall, where people like Brent Scowcroft, to some extent Chuck Hagel, others from the first Bush administration, Daddy Bush, were really making those noises. And yet, when it became clear that this war was going to happen, and it did happen, most of those voices were silenced. And it's I think, fascinating and in a way disturbing how even some substantive critiques are being neutralized or somewhat smothered. I mean, there are exceptions. People like, say, Steve Chapman, a libertarian columnist at the Chicago Tribune, very critical. Paul Craig Roberts, as you mentioned, generally we would say very far right wing, very strong against this war. But what is the practical effect of that in terms of the major media outlets and policy? I think part of the political problem, which dovetails with the media situation, is that Bush's base, I believe, is largely still willing to accept this war, and it's not a situation where his base is being seriously eroded, at least to this point.
We're talking to Norman Solomon today, Media Matters. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Thank you. I agree with your criticism of the commercial media, but my concern is, outside of the audiences for shows like Mr. McChesney's, who else is listening? Who else is thinking critically? And, for instance, have you yourself got feedback from somebody like, say, Paul O'Neill, who was, I guess, booted out of W's first cabinet and wrote about how this war was planned before the attack on America on 9/11. And I'll hang up and listen for your comments.
Thank you, caller.
I don't know about the very last comment, but in terms of, no, I haven't heard from Paul O'Neill or people of that background. I mean, the book has just come out, and in any event, he would certainly move in different circles than I would. But I would point out that there's been a lot of dissent, including before the last November election, from people like Michael Scheuer, who wrote Imperial Hubris. And I've heard him speak, read some of his writing, and, you know, the critiques are very mixed. Here's somebody who actually supported the rendition program, worked on it, which is turning over U.S. Prisoners of the United States for torture in other countries. So often, again, these are tactical critiques, and I think that's ultimately, unfortunately, how the power structures in Washington will weigh their options in terms of the situation in Iraq.
We're talking to Norman Solomon, author of the new book, War Made Easy, today in Media Matters. Norman, the way the book is structured is you've got basically 17 chapters, each of which takes, how would you characterize it, a myth, a lie?
Yeah, kind of an archetype line that is put out in support of a war.
And then you effectively, in each chapter, debunk them. And they're lines, I think, that all Americans have heard, even those who don't watch the news or follow U.S. foreign policy closely will be familiar with. The first one is, America is a fair and noble superpower. Since that's the first chapter, explain what you mean by that.
Yeah, and I should mention that that particular chapter is posted online, and anybody's welcome to take a look at it on the website warmadeeasy.com. And I think it's an example of one of the lines that are commonly heard, and yet they're often implicit. In other words, these are propaganda messages that are just assumed, or they're inherent in the kind of information and commentary that we get. So America's a fair and noble superpower is just this assumption that the greatness, the benign intent, the humanitarian and powerful activities of the U.S. government and economic structure around the planet are understood to be, and by any fair-minded person, would be known to be a fair and noble, and that really infuses a lot of the commentary and reporting that we do get.
Well, isn't that true?
Well, it's true if we go into the fairy tale renditions of reality that we have been raised on, usually in school, and certainly for the most part in the mass media. The only problem is history, and I think it was Phil Graham who tuned up the Washington Post into a world-class paper in the 50s and into the early 60s, who said that journalism is the first draft of history. Unfortunately, it's usually the last draft as well, and it's riddled with inaccuracies. And the inaccuracies are both factual and, I would say, attitudinal. As my colleague who I've traveled to Iraq and now Iran with, a freelance reporter who had a piece on Iran last week on Morning Edition, points out, Reese Ehrlich says, you know, you don't win a Pulitzer questioning the assumptions of empire.
Well, you know, you go through the book, you've got a number of these myths, lies that are sort of accepted. One that I found really interesting that certainly applied in Iraq was, this guy is a modern-day Hitler, Chapter 4. Could you explain that one, please?
Yeah, this has been very recurring in just in the last four decades. Ho Chi Minh was likened to Hitler. Then you move ahead, Noriega was in 1989. In the latter case, as with Saddam Hussein, of course, somebody who was on the CIA payroll and was quite appreciated, thank you, out of Washington for many years until there was a falling out. Of course, we heard that as well about Slobodan Milosevic in the lead-up and during the 78-day U.S. bombing of Yugoslavia in early 1999. We even heard it, and I quote this from people like George Shultz, about the Sandinista Nicaraguan regime that was, after all, the result of a grassroots revolution and then was elected in an election which, by Central American standards, was pretty democratic. And we had George Shultz writing, without questioning, in the major media that it was like the Third Reich in Nicaragua under the Sandinistas. Well, this is, you know, the sort of hyperbolic overdrive that has, you know, nothing to do with reality in many cases, and even in the instance of Saddam Hussein's regime. And I did visit Iraq under Saddam, and it was a police state. But, you know, by 2003, this was a spent and decimated military, 12 years of sanctions damaging the country severely. That army wasn't going anywhere. And yet you had Chris Shays from Congress, from the supposed moderate Republican, and others just vehemently on TV constantly saying that Saddam was like Hitler.
Yeah, I mean, if Hitler had been like the head of Estonia, he wouldn't be Hitler. I mean, Germany was the most powerful country in Europe. It was the second wealthiest country in the world.
And certainly a key characteristic when we say Hitler is that running a country that is invading others. And for 12 years, Saddam had done no such thing. There was no prospect he would do so.
Yeah, so that another Hitler. Now, the Iranians, this guy, another Hitler over there in Iran?
I think that work is in progress in terms of building the agenda. The repression there, I can say from 10 days in Tehran last month, there is repression, but there's a remarkable amount of freedom coming up from the grassroots. I was in a stadium with 10,000 people cheering for Mostafa Moin, a genuine reform candidate. The chants were political prisoners must be free. The speakers called for human rights, for true democracy, very specific. Moin that day called for an end to patriarchy, which in Iran is a very radical position. And those people are pretty free to speak. So, you know, the analogy we're going to be hearing, I think, increasingly, if not to Hitler, then at least with some of the worst regimes on the planet, will be a lot about Washington's agenda and not too much about what's actually going on in Iran.
We're talking to Norman Solomon today, Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're coming to you live on WILL AM 580. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Norman Solomon, the number here is 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Norman Solomon is the author of the brand-new book, just came out, published by John Wiley, called War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. A very factually rich and detailed critique of U.S. foreign policy and media coverage of it over the past four decades. But at the same time, I don't want to scare people away and think they're getting into someone's master's thesis, an extremely readable book, too. One of the chapters, Norman, I wanted to talk about is the next one, Chapter 5, because it seems to really get at the heart of the defense of much U.S. military action around the world. And I think the people who are the troops, the soldiers, this is the sort of belief that really has to drive them to think what they're doing is a just war, which is this is about human rights. You know, this is what we're hearing now about the Iraq War. Okay, it wasn't about weapons of mass destruction. It wasn't about 9/11. It wasn't about al-Qaeda. But now we're freeing the women of Iraq and we care about human rights. This, you say, is a recurring theme?
Yeah, I think it's a very powerful and also increasingly important theme in justifying wars. And, of course, we get into this mix-and-match thing where a president and his supporting pundits reserve the right to rejigger and reconfigure their rationales. And we've been seeing this now. You know, weapons of mass destruction went through the floor, and now it's something else. But very commonly, the human rights argument is at or near the core of the rationales for war. And unfortunately, they just don't hold up. I mean, you'd have to say that if U.S. foreign policy was about fighting for human rights and against torture, then Washington would stop paying for torture. And yet, that critique is almost, not entirely, but almost absent from U.S. media coverage, where you have, for instance, the government of Egypt that tortures political dissidents, a major recipient of U.S. foreign aid. And meanwhile, we have so many inconsistencies in terms of human rights violations that are winked at or, in effect, actively supported by the U.S. government in various parts of the world, even while we're told that we must be dropping bombs on people in order to defend human rights and prevent torture.
Then we go, The number seven in your book, they are the aggressors, not us. The other side are the aggressors. So right now in Iraq, the aggressors are the people attacking American soldiers. This is a recurring pattern as well?
Yeah, very much. And it even has gone to the point that in the lead up to the invasion of Iraq, Ari Fleischer, speaking for the White House, said that already the Iraqi regime was threatening U.S. troops. He was referring to the U.S. troops that were arrayed on the perimeter of Iraq's borders getting ready to attack. So that's kind of, you know, the extent to which this is such a stretch. Ironically, the U.S. throughout these recent decades that I chronicle has been involved in aggression. And I talk about how at Nuremberg the greatest crime was adjudged to be preparation for an execution of illegal aggressive war. And yet that is just off the media radar screen with few exceptions in this country in terms of a critique of U.S. foreign policy.
Norman Solomon, what media do you use or would you advise our listeners to use to come up with a better factual understanding of what's taking place, not only in Iraq, but with regard to U.S. foreign policy, to get some distance and perspective on what's coming out of the mainstream commercial news media?
I think it's important to have a kind of a bifocal or binocular view, so to speak, where we should be reading the New York Times, the Washington Post, our local daily, looking at mainstream news, watching the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, listening to NPR News, etc. At the same time, I think we need to be constantly looking at listening to other outlets, such as the BBC, not that it's great, but it's not so U.S.-centric and has often different sources. I think websites like CommonDreams.org, Alternet.org, others that can draw in other perspectives. And The Nation magazine, The Progressive magazine, In These Times, Z magazine, these really often just undercut the prevailing arguments and the lack of key information just in terms of counterpoint.
Who are the journalists, current journalists, contemporary journalists writing about Iraq and U.S. foreign policy that you like to read the most?
I think Juan Cola is great. I think Robert Fisk is on the scene and wonderful. Dar Jamail, I've read, an independent journalist from the U.S., often in Iraq. David Enders, who had spent most of the time since the invasion in Iraq, both of them unembedded at great risk, talking about the communities there. And that certainly gives a different perspective than what we're apt to see, say, in the New York Times.
You know, in the book, you just go through so many great things in the 17 chapters, and I know we aren't going to have an opportunity to go through all of them, which is all the more reason my listeners will have to get a copy of War Made Easy to go through the book and read it themselves. But one of the things that seems also central to all future prospective wars the United States will fight is Chapter 12. This is a necessary battle in the war on terrorism. And this, you know, strikes me coming on the heels of the confidential CIA report, which was, you know, sort of leaked a month or so back, which indicated that, as I think any rational person, actually, if you think about it, would have expected, that the war in Iraq has actually done the exact opposite than the Bush administration claims, that it's actually encouraged a wave of terrorist training that will be far more damaging to the U.S. than would have taken place had the U.S. never invaded Iraq. Yet, nonetheless, we're told this is constantly war on terrorism. President Bush's speech last week, I think, mentioned it numerous times.
Yeah.
And this is not just a recent thing. This goes back before this war?
Yeah. If you go back to coverage of the Vietnam War and statements from the White House, you had very early on President Johnson, and I quote him in the book, saying that if the U.S. did not hold firm, then terrorism would win in Vietnam. So I think this has been a useful theme. However, it certainly has been enormously pumped up since 9/11 to a huge degree. I think you could make an argument very strongly that from a rational standpoint, U.S. foreign policy and its wars currently have nothing to do with authentically fighting, blocking, preventing terrorism. You make much more easily, based on the evidence, the opposite argument. But it's a tremendously useful phrase. I mean, in my own writing and when I speak, I do not use the phrase war on terrorism or war on terror without quotation marks, because I think inherent in the term is propaganda. This is something that is such a drumbeat that if we accept the terminology, we've given away a lot of the argument to begin with. There's one other aspect I should mention, which is that Reuters raised a lot of eyebrows after 9/11 by refusing to just attach the label terror and terrorism to certain international actors, whether government or non-governmental. And they got a lot of flack for it, but I think it's a quite correct point that terrorism is a judgmental term. And to say, for instance, that the Israeli government is fighting terrorism but not engaging in it would be very disputable from the standpoint of the, for instance, many children, at as Beth Selim, the Israeli Human Rights Group, has pointed out, many Palestinian children who have been blown up by actions that the Israeli government needed and had to know would take civilian lives. And you can extend that to U.S. actions in Iraq. So to say that certain actions are terrorism and certain are not, just based on a kind of a values judgment on what's in the hearts and minds of those who are waging the war, it makes no journalistic sense. It just makes propagandistic sense, which is largely why we get so much of it in our own news media.
We're talking to Norman Solomon today, author of the new book, War Made Easy. We have a couple callers waiting I'm going to get to in a second. The number 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455, the toll-free number if you want to chime in. Before we get to the calls, though, Norman, I mean, the logical question I think people are going to ask, maybe not the callers waiting, but I'm going to ask for someone, is why does the media go along with this? I mean, after sort of, you know, blowing it war after war and being proven wrong, even in this war, why are not the news media saying, okay, enough of this baloney. We've read your book, Norman Solomon. This makes perfect sense to us. We're not going to do this again. We're going to really be a sentinel that holds up and makes sure that this country doesn't go to war under false pretenses.
Well, reliance on official sources is so critical to the normal operating procedure of these media outlets, and the rewards are many for reliance on official sources. The penalties are few for the particular journalists as well as for those institutions. I think it's quite ironic, Judith Miller being faced with jail time now for not revealing sources around the Valerie Plame, Joe Wilson issue, and yet she has faced really no appreciable professional problem inside her own New York Times organization as a result of putting absolutely deceptive stories about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq on the front page of the New York Times in the lead up to the war. She, you know, Jason Blair gets really slammed in the media for making some stuff up. She puts stuff on the front page of the Times that actually helps drag the U.S. into this horrible war in Iraq. And Bill Keller and the rest of the hierarchy of the New York Times defend her. So the penalties aren't there. One other way I could respond to the question is to kind of recount a little anecdote. I wrote a column along the lines of what I was saying a few minutes ago about the need for an even-handed use of the term terrorism in U.S. media, and I got an email from a columnist who covers television for one of the largest newspapers in this country on the East Coast, and he said, I agree with you, but if our newspaper adopted in its reporting the kind of even-handed standard that you're advocating in use of the words terror and terrorism, we would be immediately deluged with huge economic consequences. Advertisers, subscribers, the synergy between the two would fall down on us like a ton of bricks.
We're talking to Norman Solomon today on Media Matters, author of the new book, War Made Easy. We've got three people patiently waiting. Let's get back to the phone lines. Line 4, Oaklawn, Illinois. You're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Hi. Thank both of you, gentlemen. Was to your media conference twice. Appreciate everything you're doing to help our great nation at this time. And the question I have is, how far along are we with these bases we're building in Iraq, because I think that'll determine when we enter Iran.
Well, thank you, caller. Yeah, Norman, you've been to Iraq. You know the area as well as just about any American journalist. What's your sense of these bases that don't get a whole lot of coverage, but you hear about them sort of obliquely at times?
Yeah, I haven't been to Iraq since the invasion, and I've only read about them. The last number I heard was 14 in various stages of construction, and I don't really know specifically what's flying in and out of them. I do know that they are explicitly being built as permanent bases. The assumption is that the freely elected governments of Iraq will continue to make welcome U.S. troops if the regime in Baghdad knows what's good for it, I think is what's implicit. In terms of what that means for a possible attack on Iran, what I don't want to claim to have a crystal ball, but I would be very surprised in the next 18 months if there wasn't a major air attack on Iran emanating probably from the U.S., possibly from Israel, but probably from the American forces. And I'd be surprised if there was a lot of on-the-ground involvement during that time, just because of the people power issues for the Pentagon.
Okay, let's go back to the phone lines. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Hi. When you said you didn't want to be stealing the caller's question, I'm afraid you may have taken a little of my breath away, but I will try to put some things in different perspective.
Okay.
I learned in junior high school at the age of 13 that national leaders created artificial wars, foreign wars, when they felt their domestic support was lacking. And we got examples from hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years all the way back to the Romans. And I find it very hard to believe that such elementary history as this is ignored by everybody, both in terms of the non-existent weapons of mass destruction and that the fact that there was no Gulf of Tonkin incident and that the Congress eventually reversed the War Powers Act, although something else got passed in its place. I just, you know, those condemned, what is it, those who do not read history are condemned to repeat it?
Mm-hmm.
I can't believe the pundits don't get on the air and say, look, he's doing the same thing as the Caesars did and all the rest of these guys did.
Yeah, well, part of that is the Pearline letter. It's hidden in plain sight. It's a big elephant in the living room that is maybe too threatening to talk about directly. And this became accentuated right after 9/11. You know, if you look at a poll that appeared hours before the horrible events of 9/11, you see Bush was in serious political trouble already in his first half of his barely one half a year as president. And 9/11 was a political godsend for the Bush administration. Then you go ahead to a kind of a generic dynamic that I talk a little bit about in the book, where it's very difficult for most presidents to implement significant domestic changes. And you can look at Clinton and health care, so-called reform. You can look at Social Security and Bush. It's very tough to get that stuff through Congress to make it a landmark legislative change. It's relatively easy to bring about a huge war, if you want to. And I've been trying to find an instance where a president in my lifetime, I'm 53, has wanted to go to war and hasn't been able to. They get to have their way. There's also the benefits, and you're referring to this, I think, as well. Remember the beginning of the summer of 2002, the front pages were filled with stories about economic woes, Bush on the ropes politically, the economy could sink the Republicans in the November 2002 elections. By the end of the summer, the front pages were filled with Iraq. And I call that not wag the dog, but wag the puppy. There was no war that took place before November 2002, and yet the very drum roll for the war, the agenda setting, was tremendously valuable in political terms for the incumbent in the White House.
We're talking to Norman Solomon today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. We're talking about Norman Solomon's brand new book, War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death, just published this week by John Wiley and Sons out of Hoboken, New Jersey, a book I think that's going to have a tremendous amount of influence in this country and get a lot of readership and discussion going. One of the things you talk about in here, Norman, that really gets at an issue I think that many people who are concerned and oppose this war have to wrestle with, which is the question of the troops. Back in the Gulf War, I think was the first time we really saw the notion support the troops as being the reason to support a war. And I think it was Irwin Knoll, then the editor of The Progressive, who was on the McNeil Lehr Show, who made the point that few people have made since then, that support the troops was used as a justification for the war because they can't support the war policy. So you stand behind the troops rather than the war. And I think it's been a very sensitive issue for anti-war protesters and dissidents to be seen as being anti-soldier, if only because soldiers, you know, are Americans. They're our fellow people, largely coming from poor and working class families. Are the soldiers heroes? I mean, this is sort of a debate that goes on. Do you think they're heroes? And, you know, how do we support the troops? You know, how do you deal with those issues?
Well, with a lot of reflection, I think, and a lot of discussion. I know I've talked with a fair number of Iraq War veterans, and it's very informative and illuminating. You know, just to kind of step back for a moment, you know, Chris Hedges in his book, one of his books, he did War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning and also What Every American Should Know About War, Every Person Should Know About War. And he explored this whole myth of spitting on the returning troops from Vietnam. And he says, as far as can be ascertained, it's a total myth that there was no spitting on the U.S. troops coming back. But there was certainly more anger and negativity towards the U.S. soldiers in Vietnam as individuals coming from the anti-war movement than we've seen this time. I think that anti-war sentiment and anti-war activists have become more mature in the last few years and separated as much as perhaps possible the warrior from the war makers. And I think it's a difficult line. This is an economic draft. Many low-income people drawn into the military for seeking some sort of opportunity. I think they've made themselves tools of an immoral foreign policy in war. But I don't claim to have the last word on that, to make those moral judgments. People kind of have to look into their hearts and see what makes sense. But I do think speaking human to human to soldiers is very important. And the advent of groups like Military Families Speak Out, very important now, increasingly present in the media, is quite a positive trend.
We're talking to Norman Solomon. We've got someone who's been waiting patiently on the phone lines. Urbana, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Hello, Norman. And thank you for taking my call. Something that's been bugging me is why there's absolutely no coverage, left or right, in the media of the Iraqi Communist Party, a rather substantial force, actually, probably 10% of the electorate, although I believe there are three factions. And question number two, sort of a side dish for the table if there's room, is do you think the Internet represents the final stage of the bourgeois democratic revolution? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, that's I like those questions. Yeah, go ahead, Norman.
And the question was the Internet representing – I didn't catch the word.
The final stage of the bourgeois democratic revolution.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll take that one first. You know, I think the Internet, while tremendously valuable, becomes oversold. There are limits to it, and I believe that effective social movements do involve both community and reaching out beyond the community to people who are perhaps a little receptive but also resistant. And ironically, the cyberspace can also serve as cul-de-sacs. So, you know, the notion that we're going to really overturn the established order with enough clicks of mouses, I think, is incorrect. At the same time, clearly that the Internet is tremendously valuable locally, nationally, and internationally for circumventing and evading and transcending the established media outlets. On the point of the Communist Party in Iraq, I have to confess, knowing very little, when I was there, they were totally outlawed, and I didn't have much first-hand experience about it, although I think the caller is quite right. They're much more significant politically and have been than U.S. media have at all acknowledged.
You know, going back to the caller's question, his second question, the first one you answered about the Internet, Alexander Coburn, who's been a guest here, who has the website counterpunch.org on the Internet, has written widely now in the past several months arguing that people who are against the war, progressives, people who dislike mainstream news, should stop even whining about it, as he puts it, worrying about it, and just do their websites like counterpunch.org and just, you know, proceed full speed ahead, and that will solve the problem. We don't really have a problem with media anymore. That's been licked thanks to the Internet. What's your take of that?
Yeah, I have a strong distrust of any argument that touts a silver bullet. I don't think that problems are single, and I don't think that any solution can be implemented that is not multifactorial. So I just don't go along with the either-or. And I do think that we can become as filled with illusions doing work on the Internet as anywhere else. I think it's one reason why the Howard Dean campaign didn't do nearly as well as people assumed, for instance, in the Iowa caucuses, because, you know, if you judge from the Internet, they were just tearing up the place, doing so great. But it's quite possible to be very insular, and in a country of this size and diversity, we just can't afford to do that.
What is your take, Norman Solomon, on the state of U.S. politics today, particularly in Washington, looking at the Democratic Party and its position on the war in Iraq? I mean, are we seeing the degree of are the beliefs and concerns of the American people being accurately reflected in the two political parties?
I think we can depend on the Democratic Party to be significantly behind the grassroots of what is their ostensible base. And, you know, we're seeing that in terms of the war and making links between the war and the destruction of social services and community resources around the United States. The Democratic Party, you know, continues to be, I can't say a huge disappointment because we shouldn't have had a lot of expectation, but really egregious in terms of keeping space, taking up some degree of space with ostensible loyal opposition, and yet there's way more loyalty than opposition to this military-industrial media complex that we're up against.
Norman Solomon, we've only got a couple of minutes left, and I do want to get back to your book, War Made Easy. If you could, you know, tell our listeners, you know, what we haven't talked about that's in the book that you're especially proud of, that you want to draw their attention to, please do so right now.
Yeah, I like that the book was able to go into a forgotten war that was very much based on lies. That's the invasion of the Dominican Republic in 1965. I think we need to recapture our history. And also to look at ways that the news media manipulate us with lines that we may just accept. For instance, that the government is at fault for not doing better PR. This is just an example that, you know, if we can just do a better job selling American foreign policy, we would be ahead of the game. Whereas I think a crucial point is that our government does much too good of a job of the PR, the quest for public relations, and that we just, and I hope the book in various contexts helps people to move down the road on this. We as individuals, as organizations, as communities need to be much more willing and able to analyze, deconstruct, and confront the lies in our news media, because we will continue to have these horrific wars unless and until we can effectively do that as a society.
This book, War Made Easy, has a collection of phenomenal comments on the back cover by people like Greg Palast, Jim Hightower, Mark Hertzgaard, John Stauber. Is there a website you mentioned that people could go to learn more about it?
Yeah, the best website would be www.warmadeeasy.com.
And then there's also a Norman Solomon website, is there not?
There is, with my name.com at the end, and that includes my weekly columns.
Okay. Norman Solomon, I want to thank you so much for being our guest today on Media Matters. It's been terrific. And I want to wish you best of luck with this book in the coming weeks and months as you talk about it around the country. Are you planning any more trips abroad in the coming months?
Nothing on the calendar, but I am interested in getting back to Iran at some point.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you so much, Norman, for joining us. And we'll
thank you, Bob. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, we will be in touch with you. Listeners, I want you to remember that in just a week from today, 167 hours, our guest is going to be Mark Crispin Miller. Mark Miller is the author of a brand new book we'll be talking about, chronicling the 2004 election and his claim that the election was, in fact, stolen in the state of Ohio. And the media coverage or lack of coverage of the theft of the election. I think it's going to be a show you will never forget when you have an opportunity. Let's do it. It will be a live show 1 week from today. And I want to thank you all so much for listening. And I want to thank my producer, Andrew Boyle, for the great job organizing the show. If you all would like to get on our weekly email list, which you can for Media Matters, just send in. Let's see. I don't know how we do this now. Do I, Andrew? We don't have our new system set up for So we'll just stay tuned, and we'll get back to you next week with information on how you can sign up for our weekly email list. My name is Bob McChesney. I want to thank you all very much for joining us. We'll be back in 1 week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, mostly sunny with a high in the upper 80s and light and variable winds, becoming south around 10 miles per hour this afternoon. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 60s and south winds around 10 miles per hour this evening, becoming light and variable. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, the high in the upper 80s with southwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. You're listening to WILL Urbana, made possible by the support of our listeners, the friends of WILL. It's 2 p.m. A Prairie Home Companion is next.